Operation, we will intensify the military control in the Gaza Strip by segmenting the strip and relocating the population for their own protection. In all areas we'll operate.
The Israeli military issues expulsion orders for Palestinians in Gaza's second largest city of Khan Yunis and intensifies its bombardment, killing hundreds over the weekend, including at least five journalists. We'll get an update. Then the group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Katie J.M. Baker about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther.
Project Esther uses terms HSN Hamas Support Network and HSO Hamas Support Organization to rebrand what they call the so-called pro-Palestinian movement. That includes groups that have organized pro-Palestinian protests, such as Jewish Voice for Peace.
And today would have been the 100th birthday of civil rights icon Malcolm X.
To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
We'll speak with Malcolm X's daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, about his legacy, and with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about the family's lawsuit to release all files about Malcolm X's assassination. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's escalating its war on Gaza, killing hundreds of Palestinians over the weekend, including at least five journalists. On Sunday, Israel killed at least 160 Palestinians, including 36 people in the Al-Mawasi area, where Israeli warplanes bombed a tent camp housing displaced people. Multiple hospitals have also come under attack. Earlier today, Israel ordered the forced evacuation of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city. On Sunday, Israel announced the start of what it called a new extensive ground operation in Gaza, named Operation Gideon's Chariots. The prominent Israeli reporter, Gideon Levy, said a more apt name for the offensive would be, quote, Chariots of Genocide, unquote. Residents in Jabalia say Israel's attacks have been relentless.
They're bombing houses and the people got scared. What should we do? This is the reality of the occupier. What can I say? They treat us as if we are animals, not as humans. It was an extremely terrifying night. Many people were killed and many were wounded. It's a savage army, despicable Zionists. They do not treat us as human beings. It was a horrific night. Children and women torn to pieces, hundreds of houses bombed. And as you can see, this is why we are going.
On Sunday, Israel announced it would begin allowing what it called a basic amount of food into Gaza, following an 11-week blockade on all food, aid, and medicine. Last week, a key hunger monitor warned 1 in 5 Palestinians in Gaza are facing starvation. In more news on Gaza, NBC News reports the Trump administration's working on a plan to permanently remove 1 million Palestinians from Gaza and transfer them to Libya. On Friday, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said Israel's actions in Gaza are, quote, tantamount to ethnic cleansing, unquote. On Sunday, a group of Italian lawmakers took part in a protest on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border with Gaza. This is Laura Boldrini, the former speaker in the Italian parliament's lower chamber.
We are here to break the silence on what's happening in Gaza, the extermination of the Palestinian people. We cannot accept what's happening there.
Major Palestinian solidarity protests were held this weekend in London and The Hague, where as many as 100,000 protesters, many wearing the color red, called on the Dutch government to draw a red line and stop supporting Israel. Former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with aggressive prostate cancer just months after leaving the White House. On Sunday, his office said the cancer had spread to his bones. In a statement, Biden's office said, quote, while this represents a more aggressive form of the disease, the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management, unquote. Biden is 82 years old. The diagnosis comes amidst growing scrutiny of former White House aides accused of concealing Biden's deteriorating health in recent years. On Tuesday, CNN journalist Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson are publishing a book on the issue titled Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. On Sunday, the House Budget Committee passed a bill to give tax breaks to the rich while slashing funding for Medicaid, food stamps, and subsidies for clean energy. One estimate shows nearly 14 million people could lose health coverage under the plan. In an earlier vote on Friday, a group of far-right Republicans rejected the bill because they sought even bigger cuts. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut appeared on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday.
Well, what we're standing in the way of is the most massive transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the rich in the history of the country. This budget bill is an absolute disaster. It is going to kick over 10 million people off of their health care. Medicaid covers about a quarter of all Americans in order to pass along a new $1 trillion tax cut for the richest 1%. Nobody in this country is asking for that.
On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked President Trump from using the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to expel a group of Venezuelans detained in Texas. The justices said that detained individuals are entitled to, quote, constitutionally adequate notice prior to any removal, unquote. In related news, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, has fired two top officials who authored a report that determined the Venezuelan government is not directly backing the Tren de Aragua gang. The report contradicted a key part of Trump's rationale to invoke the Alien Enemies Act. Meanwhile, Friday, dozens of demonstrators rallied outside a Maryland federal courthouse demanding the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who was mistakenly sent to a mega prison in El Salvador. Ama Frimipong is a legal director at CASA.
What is happening to Kilmar is all part of Trump and the administration's bigger strategy to erase black and brown people from this country and inch us closer and closer to white supremacy.
New disclosure forms show U.S. Attorney Pam Bondi sold between $1 million and $5 million worth of shares of President's Trump Media Company on April 2nd, the same day Trump unveiled his plan for sweeping global tariffs leading to stock prices plummeting. He called it Liberation Day. In California, FBI officials have identified the suspect in the bombing of a Palm Springs fertility clinic Saturday as 25-year-old local resident Guy Edward Bartkus.
The subject had nihilistic ideations, and this was a targeted attack against the IDF facility. Make no mistake, we are treating this, as I said yesterday, as an intentional act of terrorism.
Investigators believe the suspect, who may have belonged to a fringe online community that promotes antinatalism or the creation of new life, died in the attack. Four others were injured. President Trump is set to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. In a post online, Trump said the call focused on stopping what he called the bloodbath in Ukraine. Trump's also expected to speak with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Last week, Ukrainian and Russian officials held talks in Turkey, but the fighting continued over the weekend, with Ukraine accusing Russia of carrying out its largest drone attack of the war. Meanwhile, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, who resigned in April, has publicly criticized Trump's policies, writing, quote, "The policy since the beginning of the Trump administration has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia," unquote. Meanwhile, at the Vatican, Pope Leo repeated his call for peace in Gaza and Ukraine and met with Zelensky on Sunday. Earlier today, the Pope also held a meeting with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. In Romania, the centrist Bucharest mayor, Nicos Dan, has defeated his far-right rival, George Simion. The election came almost 5 months after Romania's Constitutional Court annulled the 2024 presidential election won by the far-right ultra-nationalist Ceaușescu Georgescu, who was then barred from running again. Meanwhile, in Portugal, the ruling center-right Democratic Alliance has won a snap election but fell short of a majority. The far-right party Chega surged, winning a record 22% of the vote. The chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, has stepped down temporarily after staffers at the ICC accused him of sexual abuse and retaliation. Khan has denied the allegations. He made international headlines a year ago this week when he announced he was seeking war crimes charges against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and ex-defense minister Yoav Gallant, as well as two leaders from Hamas. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports U.S. sanctions are hampering the ICC's work. Microsoft disabled Khan's email account. His bank accounts were frozen. Americans working with the ICC fear they will be arrested if they return to the United States. One of the most prominent anti-corruption lawyers in El Salvador was arrested Sunday night. Ruth Lopez is the head of the Anti-Corruption Justice Unit at Cristosal, a leading Salvadoran human rights group that has frequently criticized the policies of the Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. Last year, the BBC named Ruth Lopez one of the 100 most influential women in the world. A new UN-backed study has found global hunger reached a new high last year, with more than 295 million people facing acute hunger. That's twice the total from 2020. A leading driver of global hunger has been war and conflict. Acute hunger has soared in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, the Sudan, South Sudan, Burma, and Palestine. A hunger-striking student at UCLA was hospitalized Sunday on the ninth day of her action. Maya Abdullah is one of a growing group of students at universities across the United States who've launched hunger strikes amidst the Israeli blockade on Gaza to demand their schools divest from Israel and protect free speech on campus. Hunger strikes are ongoing at Yale, Stanford, and at California State University schools. In the nation's capital, a recent graduate of George Washington University delivered a blistering commencement speech in front of a roaring crowd.
"I cannot celebrate my own graduation without a heavy heart, knowing how many students in Palestine have been forced to stop their studies, expelled from their homes, and killed for simply remaining in the country of their ancestors."
That was George Washington University graduate Cecilia Culver. She called on fellow graduates to withhold donations until GWU discloses and divests from Israel. Here in New York, the wife and newborn child of abducted Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil accepted a diploma on Khalil's behalf during an alternative graduation ceremony held by the People's University for Palestine. This is Dr. Noor Abdullah, who gave birth to the couple's first child, Dean, last month while Mahmoud was in custody.
"Every day since Dean was born, I understand more and more why the struggle matters. I hope he grows up to be as brave as his father and as brave as every single student here who has risked so much. your education, your safety, even your futures, to speak up for Palestine. Today we honor not only Mahmoud, but all of the students who were wrongfully expelled and suspended for standing up in support of Palestinian rights.
Columbia University students are graduating this week. A whistleblower reported last week the Department of Homeland Security's Civil Rights Division had just opened a probe into Mahmoud Khalil's arrest when President Trump moved to dissolve the office in March, putting officials on leave and halting ongoing investigations. At least 28 people died after powerful tornadoes swept through Missouri and Kentucky. The National Weather Service had to scramble to find forecasters to track the storm around the clock after the Trump administration eliminated a permanent overnight forecaster in Jackson, Kentucky. In labor news, a three-day New Jersey transit strike has ended after a tentative deal was reached to give train engineers a pay raise. Train service is expected to resume on Tuesday. New Jersey Transit is the third largest commuter rail in the country. And in New York, a Mexican Navy ship crashed into the Brooklyn Bridge Saturday. Two crew members died. Two dozen others were injured when the ship's three masts broke off after hitting the underside of the Brooklyn Bridge. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza. Palestinians are fleeing Khan Yunis, the besieged territory's second largest city, after the Israeli military issued expulsion orders. This comes as Israel's bombardment of Gaza continues, killing hundreds of Palestinians over the weekend, including at least five journalists. Health facilities have been under constant attack. On Sunday, Israel announced Operation Gideon's Chariots, what it called a new extensive ground operation in Gaza. The prominent Israeli columnist Gideon Levy said a more apt name for the offensive would be, quote, chariots of genocide, unquote. The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Sunday Israel would allow limited food supplies into Gaza as the population of more than 2 million faces famine after 11 weeks of a total Israeli blockade. But it's not clear exactly when that food will cross the border. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again decried the catastrophic situation in Gaza and the utter failure of the international community to stop Israel.
In Gaza, the situation of Palestinians is beyond description, beyond atrocious, and beyond inhumane. The policy of siege and starvation makes a mockery of international law.
NBC News reports the Trump administration's working on a plan to permanently remove 1 million Palestinians from Gaza and transfer them to Libya. On Friday, UN human rights chief Volker Turk said Israel's actions in Gaza are, quote, tantamount to ethnic cleansing. Gaza's health ministry confirms Israel's killed at least 53,300 Palestinians in Gaza since October 2023. The death toll does not account for thousands of people believed dead, including those trapped under the rubble, nor those killed by the indirect effects of Israel's assault on Gaza. In fact, the number could be more than three times higher. For more, we're joined in Montreal by Muin Rabbani, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies. He's a contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Muin. Thanks so much for
being with us.
If you can respond to the situation right now, the escalation of the attacks on Gaza.
Well, the situation, as anyone who's following the news can see, is thoroughly apocalyptic. There is not only an unprecedented siege, but also an unprecedented intensification of Israel's genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And judging by the statements of Israel's most senior leaders, it aims towards the complete occupation of the Gaza Strip and the destruction of everything that remains standing in the Gaza Strip, and ultimately the mass forcible expulsion of its entire population. And the past few days have been particularly cataclysmic. At the same time, negotiations about a potential new agreement are ongoing, and this will be decided neither by Israel nor by the Palestinians, but by the United States. To the extent that Israel continues with this assault, it means that it has a U.S. green light for doing so. To the extent that the situation changes, that means that Israel has been instructed by Washington to change course.
Talk about Israel partially lifting the blockade. What exactly does this mean after 11 months of a full blockade on medicine and aid? 11 weeks.
At this stage, it doesn't appear to mean very much. According to reports available this morning, Israel is preparing to permit something on the order of 50 trucks to enter the Gaza Strip. And we're talking about a population of between 1.5 and 2 million people who have been deprived of any goods entering from outside the territory since the very beginning of March. So this is clearly a drop in the bucket. I think the more important question is whether this is the beginning of a lifting of the siege under U.S. and international pressure, and just as importantly, whether Israel and the U.S. are going to move ahead with this harebrained scheme that has already been denounced by the international aid community of setting up a aid mechanism whose purpose is to force the relocation of the Gaza Strip population to specified locations where they can access limited humanitarian supplies under the watchful eye of U.S. mercenaries acting on behalf of the Israeli military and government.
Can you talk about the U.S. plan that's been reported to move Palestinians to Libya?
Yes, it's interesting that this report has now been formally denied by the U.S. Embassy in Libya. I think as a precautionary measure, given what happened to that embassy about a decade ago. But we do know that President Trump has repeatedly proposed an initiative whereby the entire Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip would be forcibly relocated outside the Gaza Strip. It would be taken over and rebuilt, presumably by U.S. real estate developers acting in coordination with Israel. And there have been persistent reports that the U.S. and Israel have been approaching a variety of countries, both within the region and beyond, to accept these forcibly displaced Palestinians. And in respect of Libya, the reports are that the U.S. has offered Libya to unfreeze billions of dollars in Libyan funds that have been frozen in international financial institutions since the reign of Muammar Gaddafi, who was overthrown and killed over a decade ago, if and only if Libya accepts 1 million Palestinians on its territory. This would increase the Libyan population by over 10%, and it's effectively bribing Libya with its own money to participate in this war crime and crime against humanity. But it seems to me exceptionally unlikely that Libya will even seriously consider this proposal for one moment, given the impact it would have on Libya's domestic politics, which is very strongly pro-Palestinian. And I think the real issue here is not the extent to which this initiative can actually be implemented, but rather the legitimization it gives to Israel's determination repeatedly expressed to expel the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip and further down the line from the West Bank as well.
On Friday, President Trump actually said, quote, a lot of people are starving in Gaza under the Israeli blockade. He said the U.S. wanted to help reduce the suffering. What can the U.S. do? What can the world do? You have up to 100,000 people in the Netherlands protesting outside The Hague. You have a number of Italian parliament members going to the Egyptian side of the Rafah border, demanding that the world stop arming Israel. Can you talk about what the solutions are at this point?
Well, you had, as you mentioned, the 100,000 approximately protesters in the Netherlands, with reports of something in the range of 500,000 in London the day before. And there is growing opposition and disgust with Israel's engineered starvation policy and absolutely genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And a number of European governments are now beginning to speak more loudly as well, calling, for example, for a reconsideration of Israel's preferential trade privileges with the European Union. But at this stage, the decision really will be made not in London or Brussels or Berlin, but in Washington, because of the extraordinary leverage that the United States exercises over Israel. And it will take no more than a phone call from Washington to the Israeli government to effect a complete reversal in Israeli policy within the space of a day. That's really the only reason we're now seeing this limited, very limited resumption of aid. And with respect to the statements by President Trump, I think we also need to bear in mind we're dealing here with a quite erratic leader who can contradict himself in the space of a day or even an hour. So what we really need to focus is not so much on what he says, but what the United States does. There are ongoing negotiations for a new agreement, and it's difficult to tell exactly what's happening there. Of course, they're being held behind closed doors, but we still need to find out the extent to which Washington is exercising genuine pressure, if any, on Israel to force it to accept an agreement that will that will lift the siege, lead to an exchange of captives, and ultimately put an end to this genocidal war.
Let me ask you finally, DropSite News is reporting a senior Hamas official received assurances from President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, the U.S. would force Israel to lift the Gaza blockade within 2 days after releasing the U.S.-Israeli citizen, Edan Alexander. Bassem Naim, a member of Hamas's political bureau, said the Trump administration reneged on its promise, saying they didn't violate the deal. They threw it in the trash. Your response to the report, and if you think that's why they lifted, Israel lifted it partially?
Well, these reports may well form part of the background of today's developments that we've been discussing. But at the time, it was, Hamas said it was releasing this Israeli soldier who's also a U.S. Citizen as a goodwill gesture on the eve of Trump's visit to the Middle East. And the Americans also said they had offered nothing in exchange. So quite clearly, there were no formal undertakings by the United States, but I think it's entirely reasonable to suppose that there were informal assurances given. And those, once again, ended up not being worth the paper they were, or in this case, were not written on. But at the same time, they could form part of the background of the developments that we're seeing now, which is that negotiations seem to have been intensified. I think it's very premature to conclude that they will succeed or result in a meaningful agreement, but there's quite clearly more going on behind the scenes than we are directly aware of.
Mouin Rabbani, I want to thank you for being with us, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies, contributor to the book Deluge, speaking to us from Montreal, Canada. When we come back, the group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Katie J.M. Baker about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther. Stay with us. Mahlouthi, the Tunisian singer performing last night at the People's Graduation for Columbia students in honor of the Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil, who is supposed to graduate from Columbia's SIPA school, the School of International and Public Affairs. Instead, he's imprisoned in an immigration jail in Louisiana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We turn now to a new report in the New York Times that takes a deep dive into Project Esther, a policy blueprint from the far-right Heritage Foundation, best known for creating Project 2025. Project Esther was launched October 7, 2024, and lays out plans for surveilling, silencing, and punishing pro-Palestinian activists, including deporting non-U.S. citizens. New York Times investigative reporter Katie J.M. Baker spoke to the people behind Project Esther for her new piece. The group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. Katie joins us now to explain. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. What did you find?
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, so I found that the architects behind Project Esther said that it's no coincidence that what we're seeing in terms of actions taken against universities and pro-Palestinian protesters on a federal, state, and local level has happening months after they released their report.
So the Forward had originally talked about this kind of white paper of the Heritage Foundation, but you went much further. You name names and talk to people behind Project Esther. Tell us who they are.
Yeah, so the woman overseeing Project Esther is Victoria Coates. She is a former national security advisor to Trump during his first administration, and she has a long history of working on Israeli matters. And then Robert Greenway ran the Abraham Accords, and he's one of the co-authors of Project Esther.
And if you can talk about what exactly their plans are, and how many Jewish groups are involved in shaping Project Esther, as they talk about, as the leaders of Project Esther talk about combating anti-Semitism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Project Esther aims to rebrand all critics of Israel and pro-Palestinian protesters as providing material support for terrorism. So that means that anyone who's ever participated in a pro-Palestinian protest at a university, for example, is potentially providing material support and should be fired or deported or otherwise ostracized from what they call open society. And there's not very many Jewish groups involved in this project. There are a few, but the task force that inspired Project Esther was primarily Christian and right-wing organizations.
Can you talk about the role of Christian Zionists?
Yeah, there are some Christian Zionists who are interested in Israel because they think that it will help bring about Christian dominion worldwide or bring about biblical end times. But there are also a lot of Christians who just see shared Judeo-Christian values and support Israel for that reason. And I think most interestingly, Heritage incorporated a lot of arguments about anti-Semitism into their attacks on higher education more generally after October 7th, and they blame DEI, Black Lives Matter, those types of progressive movements for what they see as the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses.
I wanted to turn to someone you quote in the piece. Democracy Now! Spoke Sunday with Stephanie Fox, the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, to ask for her response to what you exposed about Project Esther.
You know, Project Esther was created by the ultra-conservative white Christian nationalists and should be understood as an addendum to Project 2025, which is the Heritage Foundation's plan to remake the U.S. in an ultra-conservative image. It has absolutely nothing to do with Jewish safety, and it is intended solely to destroy the Palestinian Liberation Movement using tools that can then be used against all communities and movements and democracy itself. We can see clearly that Project Esther sets out a path for the Trump administration to sharpen those legal regimes that will best advance MAGA goals. So, for example, the targeting of international students like Mahmoud Khalil for abduction and deportation because of their political views is a terrifying attempt to expand already unjust counterterrorism and immigration laws against Palestinian rights movement, immigrant communities, and civil liberties writ large. The Trump administration and groups like the Heritage Foundation think that if they target the groups they believe to be most vulnerable, so Palestinians, anybody who will defend Palestinian human rights, immigrants, trans people, then nobody will stand up and fight back. But this country's fascist turn is not inevitable. If a united coalition can beat back these attacks now, we can destroy the momentum of Trump's broader agenda. And we understand that what justifies that agenda is the same thing justifying U.S.-backed Israeli genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. We see the twin evils of the cynical use of false accusations of anti-Semitism that ensure the Israeli government can't be held accountable, and also the pervasive and constant racism and dehumanization against Palestinians. Those tactics are decades old, and frankly, they've had bipartisan support. The MAGA right is now consolidating and accelerating those. And so it's on us to remember that they rely on the weaponizing of anti-Semitism and the deploying of anti-Palestinian racism because they've lost the argument. The very notion, take for example, the Hamas Support Network, which is the term used by the Heritage Foundation to describe the Palestinian Liberation Movement, it's a contrived and baseless smear that is obviously intended to vilify any and all criticism of the Israeli government. And the accusations would be laughable. They'd be they're outlandish, they're baseless, if they weren't being translated into such deadly serious policy endangering people's lives right now. But there are millions of people, including the majority of Americans and a growing and massive number of Jews, who want to see a stop to the Israeli genocide of Palestinians, who are outraged at our tax dollars being used to murder and starve tens of thousands of children, and who want the U.S. and Israeli government held accountable for their crimes against humanity. And it's in the face of these repressive attacks that our only option is to be bolder, clearer, and defensive Palestinian life every single day, and to be demanding justice, equality, and freedom for all people, no exceptions.
That's Stephanie Fox, executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace. One of the groups that Project Esther identifies, as she refers to it, as a Hamas support organization, HSO. Also, they refer to HSN's Hamas Support Network. If you can talk more about that label.
Yeah, so Project Esther focuses on anti-Zionist groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace, but they aim to go much more broader than that. So there's a whole network, according to them, that includes not just those groups, but large nonprofits like the Tides Foundation, George Soros as a mastermind on top of this pyramid that they showed and pitched at to potential donors. Then, of course, there's colleges and universities that are harboring these organizations, members of Congress, senators, the media, really anybody, you know, like I said before, who has criticized Israel or participated in any sort of pro-Palestinian activity.
How has the Trump administration begun to fulfill some of the objectives outlined by the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther?
So I want to be clear that the Trump administration would not speak with me for this story. And Heritage says it could just be a coincidence that they don't know if they're actually following the blueprint. But according to my analysis, the Trump administration and other Republicans have called for more than half of the actionable goals in Project Esther, or they appear to have called for them at least. And so I think it's worth looking at the document in full to have an idea of what else we might see coming down the line.
You write in the piece, Project Esther's architects envisioned outcomes that at the time might have seemed far-fetched. Now, 4 months after Trump has taken office, Heritage Foundation leaders are taking an early victory lap.
Yeah, so again, they won't say for sure. And I, you know, if you recall last year, Project 2025 was so contentious. It became such a big talking point during the election campaign that Trump had to distance himself from it. So they're very careful to keep their distance from each other. But they do say that they meet regularly with officials from the administration. And Mr. Greenway said to me that it was no coincidence that we're seeing actions such as billions of dollars withheld to universities for federal funding. We're seeing calls to monitor the social media of immigrants for quote-unquote anti-Semitic activity. We're seeing the, you know, attempts to deport people who have criticized Israel or argued for Palestinian rights. And so all of that is very clearly laid out in Project Esther.
And what Republican lawmakers are involved in formulating the objectives of Project Esther?
I think there's a really broad brush. You see people in the administration, Republicans in Congress. It's really hard to just pick one or two because it's really widespread.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. The response of Project Esther to your report, the Heritage Foundation people behind it?
I haven't heard from them, but I think they're very explicit that this is what they're doing. They hadn't commented publicly before this, and I really had to bug them for a while to get them to comment. But this is all laid out online, and it has been for months.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll certainly link to your report in the New York Times. The report headlined, "The group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement." I want to thank Katie J.M. Baker, author of that article in the New York Times. As we wrap up this segment, we're going to turn to the final comments of Dr. Noor Abdullah. She spoke on Sunday night at the people's graduation for Columbia University. It was a gathering of hundreds of people allied with the students who were involved with protesting at Columbia University over the last year. Dr. Noor Abdullah, who is a dentist here in New York, gave birth to the couple's first child, Dean, last month. She held her child wearing a graduation cap that had a Palestinian flag on it as she accepted a diploma on her husband, Mahmoud Khalil's behalf. She addressed the crowd.
I'd like to end by reading a statement from Mahmoud that he wanted me to share with you all. Thank you for holding me in your hearts today. It has been 2 months since I was taken from my family and from you, detained simply for speaking the truth about Palestine. Columbia University, the place where we sought knowledge, justice, and truth, chose silence instead of solidarity. It failed me, but you didn't. You showed up. You reminded me that while institutions may abandon us, the people never will. Today, I want to say congratulations. You've made it through, perhaps not with degrees, but with your voices, your integrity, and your compassion intact. I'm endlessly proud to be among you, and I carry your love with me every day. Please keep carrying mine. And thank you all.
That was Dr. Noor Abdullah. At the end of the event, graduates lined up. They're actually graduating this week from various schools at Columbia University to receive their diplomas, and projected on the back of the stage, the church on the Upper West Side, was a diploma for Mahmoud Khalil, also for Dr. Noor Abdullah, and for their baby, who Mahmoud Khalil has never seen. For Dean Abdullah. When we come back, today would have been the 100th birthday of civil rights icon Malcolm X. We speak with his daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, about his legacy, and with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about the family's lawsuit to release all files about Malcolm X's assassination. Back in 30 seconds.
History's not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine-robed men or billionaires or bankers. It's not made by them.
Black Spartacus Heart Attack Machine by Tom Morello in our Democracy Now! Studio back in 2011. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 100 years ago today, on May 19th, 1925, the man who would become known as Malcolm X was born in Omaha, Nebraska. Malcolm X would go on to become one of the most influential political leaders of the 20th century before he was assassinated at the age of 39 on February 21st, 1965, as he was standing at the podium before a crowd in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. His wife, Dr. Betty Shabazz, pregnant with twins and sitting next to her four daughters, aged 6, 4, 2, and 5 months, were in the ballroom looking on. In 2023, the family of Malcolm X filed a $100 million wrongful death lawsuit against the FBI, the CIA, New York City and state, and the NYPD, as well as the district attorney's office, for concealing evidence of their involvement in Malcolm X's assassination. Now his family is calling for President Trump to release more details about Malcolm X's assassination, just as he released thousands of unredacted files related to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and vowed in an executive order to release files on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The state of Nebraska officially designated May 19th as Malcolm X Day in 2024. His daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, was recently there to remember her father's legacy and joins us in our studio. But first, we go to an interview. In the 1960s, when Malcolm X briefly spoke about his childhood, he was questioned by Chicago reporter Jim Hurlbut in a clip featured in the PBS American Experience documentary Malcolm X, Make It Plain.
You were born in Omaha, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you left, your family left Omaha when you were what, 1 year old?
I imagine about a year old.
And why did they leave Omaha?
Well, to my understanding, the Ku Klux Klan burned down one of their homes in Omaha.
They had a lot of Ku Klux Klan. This made your family feel very unhappy, I'm sure.
Well, insecure, if not unhappy.
So you must have a somewhat prejudiced point of view, a personally prejudiced point of view. In other words, you cannot look at this in a broad academic sort of way, really.
I think that's incorrect, because despite the fact that happened in Omaha, and then when we moved to Lansing, Michigan, our home was burned down again. In fact, my father was killed by the Ku Klux Klan. And despite all of that, no one was more thoroughly integrated with whites than I. No one has lived more so in the society of whites than I.
So that was Malcolm X in the 1960s. Today would have been his 100th birthday. And today, the National Action Network will commemorate this birthday with Reverend Al Sharpton and National Civil Rights Attorney Ben Crump, who joins us now remotely, and with members of his family, including Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice here in New York City, a community organizer, an activist, award-winning author of many books. Her memoir is titled Growing Up X, her most recent book for young adults, co-written with Tiffany Jackson, titled The Awakening of Malcolm X. Dr. Shabazz is the chairperson of the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Before we turn to Ben Crump, Dr. Shabazz, it's great to have you with us again. Your thoughts as you watch your father talking about growing, being born in Omaha, being forced out by the white supremacists there, his legacy.
You know, and as I shared with members in that community, that was the legacy, that was the foundation for my father. His parents instilled these specific values of love, of care, compassion, environmentalist. It's such a beautiful place. And it is just so indicative of how this young boy would grow up to be this iconic human rights figure. Hmm.
Well, I want to come back to that legacy, but Ben Crump, I know you have a court Zoom in a few minutes, and I want to make sure we get in this lawsuit that you filed and the demand that as President Trump releases most of the documents in the case of the JFK assassination and says he's going to do it in the case of the King assassination, you're in the family's demand that they release the Malcolm X assassination documents. What exactly you're calling for, and tell us about the lawsuit.
Certainly, Amy. First, I want to say thank you to Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz and her family for keeping the legacy of Malcolm X alive 60 years later on what would be his 100th birthday. We can never say thank you enough. As it relates to the court case and celebrating his enduring legacy, we continue to fight for justice for Malcolm X by any means necessary. We are calling for truth and transparency to finally be the prevailing factor in all of this legal minutia. We know that the FBI files exist. We know that they were surveilling every waking moment of Malcolm X's life. We know that they were aware of assassination attempts on Malcolm X before he was fatally killed in the Audubon Ballroom. And so in our lawsuit that we filed for $100 million against those who conspired to assassinate Malcolm X, one of the great thought leaders of the 20th century, we continue to try to make absolute certain to everybody who's paying attention that this was an intentional effort at the behest of the leaders of our government, that being New York Police Department, the FBI, the CIA, all the way to the very top. And so therefore, finally, 60 years later, on what would have been his 100th birthday, we implore the federal government to release all of the FBI papers on Malcolm X.
You know, as you sue the city, it makes me think about the fact the mayor is going to be with you. Is that right? Today at noon, Mayor Eric Adams, who is a former police officer, and now he's the mayor, and he has ability to release information about the assassination. Ben Crump, do you know if he's going to do this?
Well, you know, we are involved in litigation with the city of New York, and it is our hope that he is going to be able to speak with Dr. Shabazz as well as other civil rights leaders who are encouraging him to help finally get justice for Malcolm X's family. You see, Amy, you know, 2.5 years ago, the city entered into a settlement agreement with those two brothers who were wrongfully convicted for killing Malcolm X. And when you really think about it, those men suffered. But who suffered the greatest for the assassination of Malcolm X? It's Malcolm's family, his wife Betty Shabazz, his daughters. That's who suffered the most. And can we finally give them some measure of justice and accountability? That is what this fight is for. In fighting to pay homage to Malcolm X's enduring legacy of self-expression and self-determination for Black people all over the world, as well as those oppressed by the oppressor and then exploited by the exploiter, what we want to do is make sure there is some measure of justice, some measure of accountability to Malcolm's family, to say that we understand that even though the assassin's bullet may have killed him, we never stop fighting for Malcolm X's life, for his justice, and for his accountability.
Well, Ben Crump, I want to thank you for being with us. Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, there'll be an event tonight at the Audubon Ballroom where your father was gunned down before your very eyes. How old were you at the time?
I wasn't quite 3 years old. But I have to tell you, in all the work that I do, I always think about my mother because she was a young woman. She had four little girls. She was pregnant with twins. Her home had been firebombed. A week before. And she saw 21 bullets ripped through my father's body on February 21st. She offered him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. She gave him the most comfort she possibly could. So I often think of how she safeguarded her husband's legacy and how she raised all six of her girls in this bubble of love. You know, in spite of all of the trauma, there was no despair, there was no bitterness that she showed to her children.
I wanted to go to your dad speaking a week before his assassination about the very firebombing you're talking about that almost killed you.
That's right.
My house was bombed. It was bombed by the Black Muslim movement upon the orders of Elijah Muhammad. Now, they had come around to, they had planned to do it from the front and the back so that I couldn't get out. They covered the front completely, the front door. Then they had come to the back, but instead of getting in directly in the back of the house and throwing it this way, they stood at a 45-degree angle and tossed it at the window, so it glanced and went onto the ground. And the fire hit the window, and it woke up my second oldest baby. But the fire burned on the outside of the house. But had that one gone through that window, it would have fallen on a 6-year-old girl, a 4-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old girl. And I'm going to tell you, if it had done it, I'd taken my rifle and gone after anybody in sight. I would not wait. And I say that because of this. The police know the criminal operation of the Black Muslim movement because they have thoroughly infiltrated it.
Because they've thoroughly infiltrated it, and this is the information you're trying to get right now. You were that 2-year-old that he was referring to along with your sisters.
Actually, that was, yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
So this is 100 years later. You're keeping, to say the least, your father's legacy alive along with so many around the world. And as you teach people at John Jay College, students, what do you think it's most important to understand about Malcolm X?
This sense of compassion. He introduced a human rights agenda to the civil rights movement. And so there are people all around the world who recognize our, every single individual's human rights. You know, he said, I tell you, there's just so many thoughts. But when I think of my father most, he was such a young man. You know, he was in his 20s when the world learned of him, 39 when he was assassinated.
He, like King, were assassinated when they were 39 years old.
That's right. They were assassinated both at 39. And he said, I don't know why I keep going on a blank, but this quote that is so important by introducing this human rights agenda to the civil rights movement for the first time.
We're talking to Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters. She's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as well as an activist. If you can talk about, you have the two men who are held in prison for decades. They've won tens of millions of dollars from New York City. They were exonerated. What would it mean for you to settle this lawsuit?
Well, you know, it's principle. And the quote that I was thinking of my father, he said, oh, gosh, every time I want to say it, so maybe I'm not supposed to say it, right?
Well, I bet you're going to say it tonight, and we're going to record it and play it on Democracy Now! In the coming days.
Okay. And, you know, one word that I can recall growing up with hearing from my mother is the word surveillance. And so I think of how oh gosh, what is going on with these words? How my mother must have been traumatized at such a young age to experience and live through all of this, my father being such a young man, you know? And so we most definitely want to ensure that we get justice for our father. You know, he sacrificed his entire self. He, you know, he said, we demand our human rights as your brother. There is no asking. We demand our human rights as ordained by God. And I would imagine it's the reason why there is this reverence for this young man whose legacy continues to inspire, empower, uplift people all around the world.
You're wearing all white today. Not black, to remember your father, the fact that he was assassinated, but white. Why?
Oh, you know, it's, you know, the spirituality. It's just a bunch of things. And I love my father. I love my mother so much. And, you know, whatever I can do to keep these legacies alive and thriving and, you know.
And tonight you'll be at the Audubon Ballroom, which your mother fought to save from destruction when Columbia was building its big biotech building. And there you have so many events honoring Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz.
And I want to say that my mother turned this place of tragedy into a place of triumph.
Dr. Ilyalsa Shabazz, on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Podcaster, documentary filmmaker, and professional blurred. Fan of democracy and OG hater of fascism and apartheid. Joyanne Reed is best known as an American political commentator and television host. She was a national correspondent for MSNBC and is best known for hosting the political commentary program, The Readout, from 2020 to 2025. Her previous anchoring credits include The Reed Report from 2014 to 2015 and AM Joy from 2016 to 2020. Fresh on the heels of her panel discussion at the Journalism Under Fire, Guarding Against Threats to Our Democracy fireside chat that took place in Washington, D.C., we have one of the greatest defenders of democracy, advocates for marginalized people, and one of the brightest political minds of our time, the one and only Joy Ann Reed. This is the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
And I am your host, Q Ward.
All right, Joy Ann Reed. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing better now after that introduction. I need to take y'all with me everywhere I go.
Listen, man, we get on the stage. We'll make you. We'll let the people know exactly who they got coming up. So you know, we wouldn't be mad at that at all. Listen, I want to say our listeners know this, but I want to make sure that I say it to you that you are more than the introduction. You are more than. You know, what you represent and the work that you do really does matter. And I'm at a loss for words. It's just, it's a very, very special episode to be recording with you. You know, we've kind of been in similar circles over the years and, you know, tried to get a word to you, but we understand and respect the work that you're doing. And when the time is right, you know, maybe we'll get a chance to have a conversation with you. And today is that day. So this is kind of like, you know, all of our stars in alignment and 10 Christmases at once. So so welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
All right. Absolutely. All right. So first off, talk to us a little bit about the fireside chat that I mentioned, because that's kind of been the big deal in the news. So this took place at the Journalism Under Fire event. For people that weren't able to attend, or people that might have heard about it and been curious about it, talk to us about, you know, what took place and maybe what people should know, what the people that attended might have learned from that event.
Well, I mean, this was an important conversation. Of course, Nicole Hannah-Jones being one of the most seminal and important figures in modern journalistic history. I mean, obviously, her creation of the 1619 Project blew up the world, broke the brains of the entire American right, set Christopher Rufo and others off on a tear to try to destroy diversity, equity, and inclusion and their version of critical race theory, which they didn't even clearly understand. But I think what's happened now is that, particularly after the election for the second time of Donald Trump, is that you have a real aggressive Project 2025 driven right-wing Christian nationalist-driven war on everything from journalism to basic freedom to immigration to potentially birthright citizenship, you name it, it's all being torn apart. And this particular gathering was to really talk about the journalism piece and how in each of these three instances, there was a woman from the Los Angeles Times who actually left there because the owner of the LA Times has decided to turn that seminal, you know, really august paper into a mouthpiece for Donald Trump and to suppress anti-Trump views at the paper, all the way to Robert Kagan, who is a conservative who used to write for the Washington Post until he resigned because of Jeff Bezos' takeover of the paper and his attempt to root out anti-Trump views or critical views of Donald Trump. Although I have to say that there are still people that are writing critically about Donald Trump at the Washington Post, but he's warped the mission, right? He even got rid of Democracy Dies in Darkness and said now they're now going to be about individual liberty or something like that, some neoliberal, you know, economic principle. And so that's happening everywhere. And of course, you know, I like to quote the Friday thing. I don't know how you're going to get fired on your day off, but I did get fired on my day off.
Yeah, I remember that.
Like Friday. But, you know, and, you know, I was never told why I was, and I said this on stage, I was never given a reason why I was let go and why my show was canceled and why more than 100 really experienced longtime staffers of MSNBC producers were essentially thrown out of their jobs and forced to reapply, doged. But I can take a guess, you know. I don't think it helped my case that I've been a very firm supporter of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion, that I've been a very firm believer that Donald Trump is a fascist, that as his former chief of staff and Mark Milley, his former joint chiefs of staff chair, they both said he's a fascist to the core. That's their view, not mine. His own vice president has said he may be America's Hitler. Then he became his vice president. You name it. It's clear that he has fascist instincts, and he's married himself to a group of white Christian nationalists who are very clearly trying to move the country into fascism and Christian nationalism. So saying that is probably not helpful. Also probably not helpful that I was pretty firm that, you know, it's probably suboptimal for the United States to be arming Israel with 2,000-pound bombs to drop on Palestinians at school and in their apartments and destroying mosques and everything else. So, yeah, I can take a good guess.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think we can all take a good guess. With all the major shakeups that we are all collectively witnessing in the media landscape since Trump's reelection, what are some concerns that you have about the state of journalism in the United States?
I'm very concerned, honestly. The resignation recently, we also talked about this at the forum, of the some 35-year leader of 60 Minutes, head of 60 Minutes, Bob Owens, that was alarming. And he resigned very clearly saying that he was leaving because he felt that he no longer had the editorial independence to cover the news without fear or favor the way that 60 Minutes has done since I was, you know, I've been watching it since I was in junior high school. And it has not changed. It's very tough on any president. It's not partisan in any way. But, you know, they recently did a really important, I think, report about the 235 men, and we think some women, who were shipped to El Salvador into a prison, into a gulag, without any due process, and that 75% of them have no criminal record anywhere. And highlighting the cases of people like Kilmar Brego Garcia, who was literally renditioned out of the United States, out of Maryland, without due process. And they did a really critical story on that. They've also done really important reporting on the war in Gaza and on the human rights violations therein and on the allegations of genocide therein. And they were in a lawsuit with Donald Trump because he claimed that their interview with Vice President Kamala Harris, which is a perfectly normal interview for a presidential candidate, was somehow biased. And he's sicked the FCC on not just CBS, but also on ABC, because he doesn't like the coverage of himself on ABC, on Comcast, my former employer, because he doesn't like the coverage from MSNBC or the financial, accurate financial coverage, I suppose, from CNBC, which is talking about his failures on the economy. You name it, the media is under fire. And I think when you see people like Jeff Bezos, who is not a journalist, interfering in the way that the Washington Post does what it was designed to do, when you see the owner of the Los Angeles Times bending the knee to Trump and